RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
This is CX of M Radio, the voice of customer experience professionals.
Podcast. This is your host, Darren Hood. Thank you for joining me again on today. And as always, a special welcome to those of you that are joining us for the first time. We are in the midst of anniversary celebration. The World of UX has been broadcasting now for 2 years, and I am excited. I didn't celebrate the first year, don't know why, but I'm excited about 2 years. So here we are. And one of the things I wanted to do was bring some of the guests on that we've had on over the course of the podcast. So today I've got two guests and they are meeting each other for the first time and they've been on the show before, but I'm still going to ask them to do the standard self-introduction. I've got Ben Woods, or I should say correctly, D. Ben Woods, one of my professors when I was at school at Kent State University and one of my professor peers over there. And also Michelle Packerin is joining us again on today. So I'm going to have these two introduce themselves and we're going to dive in and see where the topics take us on today. Ben, take it away from an introduction standpoint.
Sure. Hi, Darren. Hi, Michelle. I'm Ben Woods. I've been working in user experience for more than 20 years. Well, that's not quite right. I'll say digital for more than 20 years and UX proper for maybe about 15 or so. I actually run an independent consultancy with UX practitioners, researchers, designers throughout the United States as well as the world. Also manage software product development with partners in Eastern Europe. I've been an educator and trainer in user experience since 2009, working both at higher education as well as in corporate settings. So I've presented workshops to groups in Romania, Singapore, of course, the United States as well, and happy to be here.
Yeah, very, very happy to have you today, and thank you for that introduction. Michelle, it is on you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Michelle Packerin. I have been in the digital universe for about 23 years now. Started off, you know, as a web designer, you know, and then as most of us have, we're old and been doing this for a while and then, you know, became whatever this is I am now. I am the head of UX design at a digital agency here in Houston. And it's a fairly new gig for me. I just past 6 weeks there. And I have not done any of the cool stuff that Ben has. So I feel like a loser right now. But I've been working, so I've got that going. I've been doing stuff, UX stuff. So anyway, that's me.
Fantastic.
You're certainly not a loser. I just
Yeah, definitely not. Definitely not. But it's always good when you can poke fun at yourself in any kind of way. It helps, yep, helps to keep us sane, especially in this crazy world that we love, that world of UX. It is crazy. Though we're going to be all over the place topic-wise today, but I'm just excited to be able to share with these two folks. These folks are, they're near and dear to my heart. Ben, because of course he helped me along my journey and I had him for a class. Michelle is a champion of UX. I see her on LinkedIn regularly. I see her taking a stand for things regularly because these people and the people who come on my show, whether they are new to UX or not, the people who come on my show, everybody really embraces the discipline. And I respect that. And we always want to bring those voices forward to help drive the discipline forward. So that said, let's dive in. I've got a list and let's see where this goes because we'll probably end up talking about something that's not on this list at all. And that's fine too because these two are definitely capable. So let's dive in. Topic number one, I was going to get a wheel. I have that Wheel of Fortune thing. I can spin it. This is what we'll do. I might do that on another show or do it another time. But let's start off today and just to see what's on you folks' minds. Casting a wide net, topic number one to come up, the UX job market. Any and all thoughts are fair game. Who's going to start us off? I'm going to call on Michelle, and then we start with Michelle, and then we're going to ping pong back and forth. So every topic will alternate. But Michelle, you get to start us off on the topic, the UX job market.
So this is near and dear in my mind right now, because now that I'm a manager lady, I actually have an open rec for a senior UX designer, and it has not been easy. Apparently everyone on earth is also hiring right now. So that's great. I think that the job market right now there's two job markets that exist. Obviously, if you're entry level, like super entry level, the job market is a totally different little beastie. And I get that. But I think that people who have a few years in, this is a great time because everybody's hiring, right? It's not a great time for people like me who are trying to hire because we have to then compete with all these different places and stuff. And what I've been dealing with is people who are straight up not qualified at all. They're not reading the job description.
Yep.
We're only able to hire people in the US. It's just the way we're set up. And it says that clearly half the people are literally in another country. And it's frustrating. I think people have this attitude that even if you're only like 30% or something qualified, go ahead and apply anyway. Depending on where the place is, it's not like a robot that screens your application. It's a human being. And that person is me. I have to look at every application that comes in, and I'm busy. I'm in meetings 74 hours a day. So I have to take time out and like look at all these applications and be like, no, okay, you work at McDonald's right now. Awesome. No skill set. Great. Bye. It eats my time. And I really wish people would be more mindful of that when they are applying to all these jobs that they're not even remotely qualified for. It's not going to endear you to anyone. It certainly doesn't to me. Mm-hmm. I feel like you've just wasted my time and I don't have any time for that. So that's frustrating. And I think somebody on LinkedIn had one of those, like, name your problems with hiring right now. And I think I talked about that. And then someone got mad at me because there's no jobs for entry level. And I'm like, what's that got to do with my open job for seniors? That's what we're hiring for right now. That's what I need on my team. Okay. What's that got to do with you? Nothing. It's not the company's responsibility to create jobs because there's too much people, you know, there's too many people in the market. There was a time, maybe the time still exists, where people were told not to go to law school because there were no jobs for lawyers. Or law firms supposed to suddenly create positions for baby lawyers just because the supply has grown? Of course not. That's not how business works. Mm-hmm. Businesses don't exist to hand out free jobs to people because you want one. And I really wish people who are at that part, you know, that place in their job hunt would realize that as unfortunate as the situation is where you want to work in UX and there aren't a lot of entry-level roles, it's not the responsibility of hiring managers or companies to create these roles just because the supply is too high. That's my TED Talk. Thank you.
I got to get the applause in on that. You remind me of how, before we bounce over to Ben, I told people, two things came to mind when you said that. One, I told folks, businesses are not charities.
Yes.
And, well, three things. The second thing is, the only reason people are complaining, I understand that there's not a lot of entry-level jobs, but there are not a lot of entry-level jobs in any discipline. Why is it supposed to be different for you for UX? And it's funny, these people only feel that way because they are entry level at this time. And so I tell them, I got news for you. Guess what's going to happen when you reach mid-level or senior? The same exact thing. The world of UX is just weird like that. It's basically a new discipline. A lot of companies don't have their hiring for UX sorted out. The wrong people, frankly, are running most UX departments. And so all that's going to trickle down and it's going to hit the people that are applying for the job. So it's a weird arena. Google didn't help. They graduated over 300,000 people in their program to a part of the UX job market that was already oversaturated. So that doesn't, it doesn't work when you do that. And then the last thing I was going to jump on again before we jump over to Ben is I wrote something called the UX Job Seekers Manifesto. And I talked about, you got to follow instructions. It is amazing how people, when I was working at another company and I told folks, hey, we're hiring for, guess what? 2 entry-level UXers. So people said, I'm interested. And my LinkedIn inbox was getting flooded. And I got people, hey, let me know if you're interested because I'll put your name in the referral database, which can move you up the line and help you out a bit. These people, I want to say that 75 to 80% of the people that contacted me thought that by letting me know they were interested, that they had already applied for the job. They, for some reason, didn't understand. I told them, you have to apply. They didn't apply. And the recruiter would say, Darren, this person's not. I kept getting these barrage of emails. Darren, this person is not in the database. This person's not in the database. This person's not in the database. So all of these people I tried to help get an entry-level job, these people did not, they simply didn't go through the proper steps to even be considered. So a lot of times, I understand it's tough. We were all entry-level UXers at one time. I understand the challenge of it, but I know that you got to do due diligence or you're not going to get anywhere anyway. So it's just really sad how many people I've seen, they don't follow instructions and then they just complain about how nothing's available. So interesting stuff, but I'll ping pong this over to you, Ben.
Yeah. Gosh, we could talk about this for a long time. The job market for UX, I think, has really kind of shifted. Speaking for Northeast Ohio, especially, I mean, there was a time maybe 15, 10 years ago, there just weren't a whole lot of positions available for UXers. And of course, this was pre-remote, before remote was more common. You know, I think that there are so many issues with the job market, with the UX job market. I mean, there are distortions, I think, in terms of what an entry-level job is. How many times do we see entry-level job descriptions that require 2 to 5 years experience? That's not entry-level. Now, there is there is such a thing as hiring somebody who has no experience, but it's called entry-level with qualifications, right? So, okay, great. You graduated from a program. You have some body of knowledge that you can work with. Maybe you did an internship. Maybe you have some case studies that you can show. So, I mean, I'm very much in favor of hiring and finding those entry-level people. And in fact, I try to for certain tasks. In fact, I even have like a rate card where I say, you know, if we're talking with a senior level consultant, you know, they're going to be at the top. Like, and this has to be a person who has had, you know, C-level experience presenting, et cetera, all the way down to entry-level people who, they can't run a whole project. They're going to kind of be more tactical, more of a technical person. You know, you're going to set up the surveys. You might help in some of the data collection. And I think that actually kind of speaks to, you know, one of the big challenges we have in UX, that there isn't necessarily a very clear career path for developing leadership in the UX space. We have it, for example, in law. right? I mean, you start out as an associate, you kind of, you know, after several years and some success, you move up a firm or you get hired by a larger company. The other thing is, you know, just the broader jobs market, not even just UX, is just so upside down. I mean, where I live, they're hiring 15 and 14 year olds to wash dishes in restaurants because they can't get anybody. You know, but the other side of this is what are the disheartened job seekers encountering? And I mean, I know you've seen this. How many times do you apply to a job? You upload your PDF and they want you to retype everything. And, you guys really need it. Frankly, it's one of the reasons that I just can't imagine going into a job market as a job seeker, even though it's such a great market right now to get a job. You know, I think there's so many issues. There are so many people who are unqualified, and I mean, 300,000 people from Google, that is a scary number. And it just demonstrates that people don't know what they are buying. You know, there's so many companies that think they need UX and they probably do, but they don't know what they're buying.
Yep.
And, you know, I think we may have touched on this previously, the lemon problem, which we talk about in economics. You know, it's adverse selection because buyers, i.e. employers, don't know what they really need in their talent. And there's a number of people, you know, maybe some in that 300,000 cohort who aren't really as qualified as they want to present themselves. And so because of this, it kind of leads to this adverse selection where the hiring manager says, okay, we'll hire in these people. We're going to depress the salaries, by the way, because we have to discount them for risk because they've never done anything and they've come from a non-accredited program. And then they hire people who are unqualified. Then they say, you know, after 6 months, what do we get out of this? And my concern is when we have unqualified buyers and unqualified candidates, it just makes UX as a whole look bad.
Yes.
And that gives rise to things like design thinking and all sorts of other bad stuff.
Yeah, that's amazing stuff. You just made me something that stood out to me when you were saying that. Talking about the 300,000 people from Google and the risk factor. And it makes me think about a conversation I had with somebody on LinkedIn this past week. And they were saying, I posted something about entry-level folks and some of the things that they believe and accept and assume. And the person told me, well, Darren, you know, you just got to, I can't believe he said this to me. You just got to understand, they don't know. Do you think I just got dropped off from another planet? I know they don't know, but that's not the point. And the person was presenting it as an excuse. The thing I was trying to say, and just remembering what I was trying to stress to this person, was that it's funny that you're doing UX, and you have as painful as it might be, I think it's critically important, and this is the part he was really responding to, to be empathetic about see it from the job, from the company's perspective. It's amazing to me how people don't, when they're applying for jobs, isn't that hiring manager your user? Isn't that recruiter your user? Aren't you trying to get a UX job? Of all the jobs that are out here, UXers should be trying to present themselves in a way, thinking of that hiring manager or the recruiter as their user. It should help to form their what's happening on their resume, what's happening in their portfolio, what's happening in their application, all these different things. And then seeing it from their perspective, it changes how folks look at things. And instead of complaining about what's not out there, it will help you to focus more on you and understanding how you're presenting yourself. And so I just thought it was interesting that the person just wanted to say they don't know A, B, and C. Like, well, that does that stop them from presenting themselves the right way? It doesn't. And why make excuses? If somebody's ignorant, they're ignorant. We've all been ignorant before, but you don't overcome ignorance by embracing and celebrating your ignorance. You have to start to go forward some kind of way. And that's what I told the person. I've been counseling people for years, over three decades, and you never get anybody anywhere by making excuses for their current state. So you don't know, then fine. No, find out. What you don't know, identify the gaps, and fill them. Work to fill them. And please, 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 those of you under the sound of our voices today, the companies, and I love what Michelle said too, thinking about that again, that people are, you need to understand what's happening in the head of the hiring company. You need to understand what's going on. I'm hiring now too. It is a challenge, and it becomes really a huge, tremendously steep uphill battle to try to hire people when you have all these people who insist on being hired when they offer no value.
Yep.
The risk factor that Ben mentioned. People are hiring seniors because that's what they're backfilling for. They're also hiring seniors because in some cases where they're not backfilling because there's less risk. When you take on an entry-level person, there is more risk, and risk costs dollars. And companies are not willing to lose those dollars in the name of giving you a chance. Does that really make sense? No. So the lack of empathy lets me know when I hear that from people, you're not ready. You're not even ready for an entry-level position because you just don't see things from the business perspective. And I challenge people more and more to embrace that. And the more they accept it, I say, number one, stop worrying about the 50 jobs you didn't get and embrace the one that you do. There will always be more rejections than hirings.
Yeah. When I lost my job, I got laid off in 2018. I think I applied to 46 jobs. Okay. And I was at the time I had almost 20 years of experience. Mm-hmm. And I got a new job in 3 months, but I still applied to 46 jobs. Most of them didn't even like acknowledge I existed. Yep. So it doesn't magically become a completely different experience once you have a bajillion years of experience. It's still hard. And there are other people with even more experience and clout than me who get laid off and who have trouble getting jobs sometimes. And it's never going to be like, you're going to be like a rock star and you just walk in and go, hire me. And then you get hired. Maybe that happens sometimes. I don't know.
I would respond. I would say I'm concerned that actually we might be seeing other things happening where it becomes harder to get jobs as you become a senior level person. I've encountered this to a certain degree. And look, I mean, it's not like I'm hitting Social Security age anytime soon. But, you know, I've been doing this enough. I've had the right roles. You know, I sometimes get the question, well, why would you want this role? Because you were like a VP at an agency, and it's kind of like, well, you know, I can read the job description. I know what you need, and I know I can do it. By the way, there is such a thing as title inflation at smaller companies. So
yes,
that does happen. Sorry. I think you said something interesting there in the amount of ignorance that there is around, jobs, UX, et cetera. I mean, my concern is that we kind of are living in an environment in our society where ignorance is permitted and ignorance is accepted.
Yes.
And
celebrated.
celebrated because your tightly held ignorance is equivalent to my knowledge. And that is what we are seeing now more in society. And it's not a political statement because we see it in the UX profession as well.
Yeah.
We need to, I think, as a profession, start, counteracting some of that ignorance, not by saying, these people are wrong, but by talking about what UX really is.
Yes.
Right. So it's not, making pretty buttons. It's not making nice websites. It's not making e-commerce better. So I'll tell you a story. I was, one of the things that's really close to my heart is certification and, maybe licensing for UX, but what I'm in favor of is some kind of third party accreditation that qualifies people, because right now we live in a world where anybody can make their own certificate and say, I'm qualified.
Yeah.
I know we talked about this in our last talk, but it is important. And, I was putting together a talk on the need for certification for, I think it was World Usability Day a couple of years ago. And the funny thing is my wife said, well, what's the worst thing that could happen with bad UX, right? I mean, people might not hit the e-commerce button, the buy button fast enough, or they might not be able to buy something online. And I said, well,
nuclear meltdowns?
I said, was that?
I said, nuclear meltdown, maybe?
I said, I said, well, I mean, I understand why you might think that, but I would say it could range from anywhere from, yeah, we didn't make a sale or a convert, up to and including the death of people. You know, in my presentations, I talk about the fact that, look, there are certifications for braiding hair, for architects. You know, I mean, people say, well, architects, they have to build buildings that don't fall on people. Yeah, we have to build software and products that don't kill people, by the way.
So
I mean, I think that when we move away from the space of talking about, you know, colors and layouts and patterns and that sort of thing, and really start talking about the value that we deliver, which is de-risking projects, right? And ensuring that we are creating products that are not harmful to people and that sort of thing. That's when I think UX gets really exciting and really where our true value is.
Yes, absolutely. It's amazing stuff when you think about all that. And it really gets me how people oversimplify UX.
Well, and it's funny because, I mean, people ask me about my, you know, my work. And I got to tell you, I don't have a lot of e-commerce work. I've done a lot of work on enterprise software that is critically important, but not a lot of e-commerce. And unfortunately, I think that's a mark against me for a lot of positions.
It is. It is.
Yeah, and I don't have the sexy stuff either. It's all enterprise for me or eGov. I haven't done anything hot and sexy, so I can't sell that. You know, I could just sell, I know how to like solve really big complex problems. Do you want that? Because I can do that.
What the two of you just said made me think about something. I'm going to insert a topic that wasn't on the list. That's one of the reasons why I'm going to do a project. I'm not sure if it's going to be a talk or podcast episodes or what. But the trouble with portfolios that you know, you worked on enterprise, Michelle, Ben hasn't done anything e-commerce related, but you know, the things that you do, and even if you do enterprise, sometimes enterprise work can go down the same kind of creative funnel, if you will, that when some other employer sees your work, they'll discount it. Because they don't have an affinity for enterprise work. So it's like it's weird how when people, everybody's talking about portfolios and they're putting all their emphasis on portfolios, when a lot of the people, they're speaking as if the people reviewing the portfolios know how to review them. And so a lot of times the work can become the basis for discrimination. I know people who, we had another discussion on LinkedIn this past week, where somebody was asking, do you know about any hiring scenarios where people don't even want to see portfolios? They don't ask for them. I said, I do. I know some people who don't want to see portfolios in the hiring process. I know people that refuse to present a portfolio when someone asks. I know people who've been hired after they refuse to show a portfolio. It's just interesting how the whole portfolio landscape is operating these days. And how dysfunctional, and it does lend itself to discrimination a lot of times. So just a few thoughts I had about portfolios, but it's actually Ben's turn to ping pong there. So I'm going to bounce over to Ben, see what thoughts you have on portfolios and UX hiring and such.
Yeah, well, I mean, portfolios are an interesting thing. My career started as a graphic designer. So I was very familiar and comfortable with visual portfolios. The difference, though, is, you know, back in, what, 99, 2000, my portfolio was comprised of brochures, ads, that sort of thing. The sort of projects that, I mean, it was good work, but these are projects that are, you know, they come in and they're sent out within a week, right? I mean, you have to turn that stuff around really fast. Enterprise projects, you can work on the same product for 2 years. And as a result, your portfolio is not going to be particularly thick. It's going to be very deep and very dense, but you're not going to look like you have the diversity of skills, when in fact, you probably are doing very sophisticated UX work because you have to really dig deep into those products and understand those users and those processes. Portfolios, I think for UX work, it's problematic. I know I've said this many times, people who are reviewing your portfolios probably aren't qualified to evaluate UX anyways. And then it becomes a beauty contest. Yeah. And so I've been in that scenario where I've said, okay, well, you want me to send the portfolio? No, I'm not going to send you the portfolio. We can talk about it and I'll walk you through it, but I'm not going to send you, you know, my headshot so you can, you know, decide whether you like me or not. I'm not doing a Miss America thing.
That's it. That's it.
But I mean, it also, I think, speaks to, you know, I kind of harp on this, this general misunderstanding of what UX is. I'll tell you a quick story. I was, working on a website, global website. We had a new CMO, chief marketing officer, to whom our department reported. And we were talking about how to improve the company's website. I'm doing my best to keep it anonymous. Their response was, when they looked at our competitors, they're like, wow, we really like that competitor's website. And look at that, like, happy family in a tent with lights and everything. It's just so warm and happy. And we really like that. Like, the people are there, they're happy. We need to have those sorts of pictures on our website. I'm not going to argue with you about how nice the photography is, but we make, like, stuff that goes into other products. We make electrical equipment, hydraulic equipment, that sort of stuff. And you want to know what the number one request is from our actual users, not the people and not the happy family in the tent that you're talking about. The actual users want product information. They want pictures of products, not marketing fodder. Mm-hmm. That conversation did not go well.
Isn't it amazing how often people will see another site, clients and stakeholders, yes, they see another site or product, and then they say, I want to do it like that. Or today it's Google does it like this. Facebook does it like this. Amazon does it like this. Yes. And our mental models are completely different. Mm-hmm. So we can't take what they did and we can't put the square peg in a round hole.
Yeah. And that's my concern with portfolios is we're basically doing the same thing. We're, you know, which do you like better without knowing the context, the background, those sorts of things.
Yep. Absolutely.
I'll keep going.
Michelle, what's your take?
Okay, so here's the deal. You know that my background was in design. Mm-hmm. And like by design, I say capital D design, and that I went to school and learned how to design. So my level one skill set is as a graphic designer, visual design, and then I learned everything on top. Mm-hmm. Even in UX, I have always been Debbie likes to say, jack of all unicorns. I do visual design. I do UX design. I do freaking product ownership, you know, like on an Agile team. I write specifications. Shoot, I used to do front end development. I do all the things, right? So to me, I always had a portfolio because I was the jobs that I was getting, and maybe it's being in the South, there was always this idea that the jobs were expecting you to be a hybrid. I've never seen a job, you know, I'm from New Orleans and then I lived in Jackson and now I'm in Houston. I don't see a lot of these jobs where it's like this one thing where you're a specialist. It's a lot of them, even in UX and before that in web, you are expected to be a multifaceted person who had lots of skill sets, right?
Yep.
It's very hard to be expected to do visual design type of things and not show it. So like right now, the team that I'm in charge of, they're hybrids. They're UX designers, but they're also visual designers because we're an agency. We cannot afford to have specialists who just do visual design or this. The only specialists we have are our behavioral scientists because research is in my opinion, probably it needs a specialist to do it properly. That's my two cents. And they're like, cuckoo, PhD, crazy smart people, right? But my team does UX and visual design. I need to see a portfolio, at least one thing, one case study, so I can at least see how you think and see that you actually have visual design chops. I spend most of the time looking at your resume. I'm looking to see, do you actually have experience? Because I'm hiring for a senior right now, right? I need to see, have you worked? Where have you worked? I look to see how articulate are you? I work at an agency, which means that my people are talking to our clients. They need to be really smart. They need to be able to present themselves a certain way. It's very different than if you're trying to get a job enterprise where you're one of thousands of people and like your stakeholders is, you know, Linda from HR, right? Our stakeholders are people who work at other companies, and, you know, it's very important that they have different types of skills. So I'm looking to see how articulate are they when I look at their portfolio and how they talk about themselves. I'm looking to see, do they have good grammar? Can they present themselves well, but also do they know how to talk about UX and sell it properly? Mm-hmm. So to me, the case studies that I look for, I cannot stand case studies that are either all visual pictures. Like, I did something and then it's a bunch of pretty pictures, but I'm like, did you design this? Did someone else design this? And then you did something else. Why are you showing me finished screenshots that you didn't do? I don't want to see those. Mm-hmm. Or it's literally just a bunch of pictures like that. Or it's what I call UX deliverable porn, where they went to a boot camp or went to a master's program and they told them all of the things you have to have for every UX project. And it's just one by one. Oh, personas. I interviewed three people and made 14 personas. It's just in all these ridiculous, here's a user mapping journey, blah, blah, blah. And here's, I ideated and empathized and I had all these feelings. And I'm like, I look to see if they do stuff like that, because that tells me they are really green and they don't understand that in a real UX world, you never do all that stuff because it's not necessary. It's expensive. Most of it's hoo-ha. So I look at portfolios because I need to see how you think, that because people can really BS you in interviews, and they can obviously BS you through a case study as well. But people tend to reveal a lot about themselves and how they do this. And when I see what it looks like cookie cutter UX stuff, that's a red flag for me. And I'm like, yeah, they're not ready for prime time. So to me, I find them valuable. And I think people keep hearing the word portfolio and they immediately equate it with pretty. Even if you're like a straight up interaction designer, UX designer, you do not have to have any responsibility for the visual design. You can still talk about what you did. Maybe for a certain project, your job was to consume a bunch of research and then work out a bunch of wireframes and figure out how someone was going to work through a task flow. Tell me about that. Tell me the story of that really quickly. Because I have 37 seconds, but really quickly, like boom, 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 because that lets me know how you're thinking. The portfolio does not have to be a visual, pretty book like you would have in the graphic design world. So maybe if we stop thinking about it that way, people, so many UX designers would not be so like, oh, why do I have to have a portfolio? Because I know how hard it is. I worked at a job for 3 years when I worked at Memorial Hermann Healthcare System here, and I was a product owner on a product team. I worked on a bunch of things, but they were all for the same product. And I was like, how do I write a case study for all these little things? So I was trying to like, how do I figure out, how do I explain all this? So I know that sometimes it's really hard to take what you've been working on and distill it down to one story or to stories that make sense. Because sometimes you can work on something for years and it gets canceled. So now you don't have any cute ROI at the end. Most of my things, I have no idea what the ROI of it would be, because either they didn't get implemented all the way or the implementation required operationalization. within the organization that I have no control over, right? So if those things don't happen there, then it's going to impact what I'm doing over here. So I'm going all over the place. But sometimes we don't have cute ROI, and that's another red flag to me, is when you have a bunch of case studies where you're like, I solved the problem that saved us $87 bajillion. I'm like, how do you know that? Because I don't know that about any of my projects. So how do people get all these ROIs that they put in their case studies? I just want to know how you think and what you know. That's what I'm looking for.
I wanted to kind of jump onto that and kind of follow up, if you don't mind. I mean, I think, you know, 100%, I do have a portfolio. I don't have it on the on my website, but on my portfolio, I don't have a whole lot of those pretty pictures. I have pictures of whiteboard sessions, of, you know, post-it notes. We've actually, you know, analyzed things. I actually am more interested in showing the process, and you're 100% right. I mean, if you're an outside consultant, you might not know what the end result is of your work. You're not going to have the ROI, but what you can have, and what I try to convey, is what is the value and how would we demonstrate the value if we were to actually execute this? So, I mean, we do know how to measure the outcomes, and that's what we're designing towards. So, I mean, I think that's the one thing that I would add to a portfolio. One thing that I'm kind of curious about and I've been intrigued by is the idea of what is required to be a UXer. Because I get this question sometimes, like, do I have to know how to code? You mentioned if you're going to be a UX designer, having some visual capability is important. And I think I've encountered this phenomenon. I'd be curious to know if you have both encounter this. It seems like there's kind of a geographic distribution for different types of skill sets. So for example, what I find is it seems like a lot of, like, on West Coast, they really want UXers who can do some front end coding. I'm seeing a lot of, like, in Michigan and in Maryland and Washington, you know, where aerospace and automotive is, they seem to want UX practitioners who have ergonomics, for example, experience or expertise. I'm curious if you, either of you have ever encountered that.
The expectation, like when I first started, obviously UX wasn't really a thing. It was web design. We were expected to be full-on visual designers who could also build what we designed. And then maybe, you know, shoot, I did QA stuff. I did business analysis. I wrote functional specifications. I did all that type of stuff because the companies I worked for didn't have the budget to have specialized skill sets for all those. So you were expected to be everything. And I would meet people at conferences who were, like, up north or on the coast, and they're web designers and they don't have the foggiest clue about HTML or CSS. They have no idea how things get built. They just make pretty stuff and hand it off to a developer. And I'm like, yeah, you're not a web designer then, right? So I do think that there are changes, you know, there are differences in the in where you live that affect the roles. And then when UX became a thing and I kind of moved out of New Orleans and came to Houston, Houston's a very strange little place because it's so oil and gas and energy oriented. And we have a lot of UX people here, and a lot of them who work strictly in oil and gas have no visual design backgrounds or skill sets at all. They have trouble getting jobs at agencies or at enterprises because they all they know how to do is this very narrow, you know, stuff with oil and gas, which tends to be, it's not always the hottest, sexiest stuff. It's like working with drill things and you're making an interface so you could see pressure and stuff like that. So there's, what is the right word? Prejudice? Yeah, there's a prejudice against them. A guy I worked with one time, he's most of his career was in oil and gas. He kept trying to get hired on the West Coast, and the minute they found out he was in oil and gas, they had zero interest in even talking to him. Wow. Because there's this prejudice at, like, a lot of the Silicon Valley companies, at least this is what I've been told, against people who work in oil and gas because of the narrowness usually of what they're doing in their jobs and stuff like that. So I do think depending on where you are, the expectations are different and the different industries, what they're looking for is different.
The thing that I've seen, that's these are all really interesting concepts. I think people are going to get a lot out of hearing this. What I'm about to say, I think I said before, the thing I've noticed has not necessarily been the geographic impact. It has been the company impact. So sort of on the same line as something that Ben mentioned earlier, throughout my entire career, I started in 95. I started a freelance web design business doing a lot of UX-y stuff at the time, and I'm doing the back end. I'm doing everything. I'm doing logos. I was doing everything, just like Michelle just said. But when I break into, I hate that term, but I'm using it now too. When I break into UX full time, my first full time UX gig was for a bank. It was for Comerica Bank, which used to be headquartered in Detroit. Now it's headquartered down in Texas. And when I went there, I was an information architect, and I did a little bit of visual, but it was mostly the information architecture, a lot of prototype work. And then there was a lot of that whole unicorn-y thing did come into play a little bit, because I took care of Comerica.com. I was the webmaster. Being a webmaster was part of my UX responsibility. So I took care of Comerica.com. Any changes, any content that was being posted there, it had to come by me to take care of it in the little content management system that we had and things of that nature. But I was never asked to code or anything like that. I did information architecture. I did prototyping. I did a little bit of research, not much, more guerrilla oriented, nothing formal, no user testing, none of that kind of thing. But I also realized when the company moved the headquarters to Texas, I realized, you know, if I'm going to, I love what I'm doing. This is the direction I'm going to go. But I know that if I stay here, I'm not going to learn very much. If I want to grow in this discipline, I need to get higher up on the food chain. And I left and I went to a creative agency. I went to Wonderman Digital, which was part of Team Detroit. So there was Ogilvy and Young and Rubicam and J. Walter Thompson and a lot of big names in that space. I went there, and what I, that's where I began to notice, I'm going to make this long story short. I go from Comerica, I go to Wonderman, I end up at MRM McCann, aka MRM Worldwide, and I later work at Digitas, and I work at IBM, and I work for Cengage and National Geographic Learning, and all of my travels, and then of course starting to meet a lot of people and understanding what their work was like in their workplace and how their environment and how their UX culture was structured, I came to find that the work that people did, it was an affordance that was based on what was needed in that given organization. If I had gone to a startup, I was expected to do more. When I went to the agency, everybody was in their own lane.
Yeah.
And that's how we made the, that's how we made the donuts. That if we stay in our lane, we'll make lots of donuts. If people start to cross-pollinate and commandeer, and I've experienced that over my career too, the goofy story I think you folks probably heard about, I'm leading design for one wholesale mortgage company, and a developer comes in with the mock-ups that he did in Microsoft Paint, and it just floored me because I didn't even know Microsoft Paint still existed. Here you are commandeering the design because they want it to exist across multiple lanes. But I've seen where you work is going to determine the breadth of your responsibility, and where you work is also going to have a direct impact on the trajectory of your own personal UX maturity and your own personal UX career growth, because you're only going to be able to do what that company needs. You're not going to be able to stretch beyond that, or very little beyond that. So what you do, it depends on where you work. That was what I had always seen. Just throw my two cents in on that.
Very true. Yep. 100%.
Great stuff. Did we talk about churn? Yeah. I don't think we did.
I think we did in a discussion prior to going on air.
What do you folks, Michelle, it's your turn to ping pong. Your thoughts on UX churn and what's happening in the UX work world with regard to churn?
So churn is the definition where you can't keep employees or they keep changing. Yeah, definitely. Yep. I've seen that in certain places. I think that, you know, in some places you go to, if you go there and you learn a bunch of stuff and maybe you're lucky enough to have people there who are willing to train you and teach you. And I think there's a phenomenon in places like that where those people, they get that training and then they go look on the market and go, oh, well, that company over there is willing to pay me, you know, 50% more. And then you leave. And then the company that you just left just wasted. Well, I don't say wasted, but, you know, one of the reasons why a company is willing to take maybe entry level or people in their beginning stages and to train them is to try to like have them be valuable for their company, right? They're trying to teach you in their ways. Yep. And have you be a valuable part of their company. But it's a risk because you could put all that time and energy into someone. And then the minute they're actually good enough to actually go and lead a project and do stuff, they leave to make more money somewhere else. I mean, it is what it is. We're capitalists here. We live in this country. Everybody wants to make money. It's great. But it's hard. And, you know, we said before, why don't more people hire entry level? Because entry level means I have to train you and I have to, my seniors, my leads, they have to take their time and train you and give you all this information. And then there's that risk that the minute you are actually good enough to be valuable to us, you're going to just take off. And then we just wait all this time on you. So I don't think people think about the investment. Now, obviously, not every company is willing to really invest in people. But when you are hiring people at that level, you have to invest in them because they are not qualified to really do what needs to be done in any kind of level, right? You have to invest in them. And so there's so much risk involved in that. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating when you work at a company where you know that you can't pay people. I mean, now that everybody's, well, not everybody, but a lot of companies have gone remote. My company right now is now 100% remote. We have people all across the country. Mm-hmm. It's, we can't compete with people who are looking at jobs at Facebook. There's, you know what I'm saying? So if you're looking at us and Facebook, well, I mean, give me a break. We can't pay those types of things. I'm sorry, we're an agency. We make money by billing you out, right? By working on projects. Like you're the person who generates revenue type of mm-hmm. thing. Yep. Facebook makes money off ads, baby. Can't compete with that. So that's very, very hard for us when we're expending all this energy training people and then they're going to go work at one of these companies that can pay them some ridiculous amount of money. So what I try to tell people is you can go work at one of these big FANG companies and be one of hundreds or thousands of UX people. And maybe your giant contribution for the year is determining, you know, the location and label of a button. But if you work here, you are the owner, you know, the UX owner of this project. You get to be the reason that project fails or succeeds, right? You get to see the value of that work. So you have to then figure out how to storytell to the people that you're trying to hire or trying to keep, because sometimes if they come in through the agency place and this is, they came in as entry level, right? And this is the only career they've ever known. They don't know what it's like enterprise.
Yep.
Enterprise, you might make more money, but you're probably going to have much less significance. And that's any of these big enterprises. I promise you, I've worked in so many of them. The bigger the company, the less significance you are going to have. So yeah, you might make more money, but what matters to you? Some people, they don't care. They want to make money. Other people, like me, I want significance. So I don't know if that's, I'll keep going on tangents. I'm sorry.
No, that's great.
First to churn, before you blow off your job that you have now to go make a bajillion dollars more, make sure that you're not just leaving because you want to make tons of money.
Please
make sure you're leaving because where you're at now can't give you more. Like maybe you're at a level where you can't learn more or you can't grow more and you need to leave. That's the perfect reason to leave. And I'm 100% for people doing that. Sometimes you absolutely have to leave to progress in your career growth. But if you're just leaving and sometimes you're leaving for an even less significant job, like maybe you're a lead somewhere and you're going to go be a senior, but you're going to make more money, you are probably going to have much less significance and value. And so you really got to understand what matters to you before you go make that jump.
Yep. Yep. Wonderful. Wonderful. And you were on point.
I never know with me.
I mean, there's a lot to say about it, but go ahead and dive in there, Ben.
Yeah. The whole issue of churn in the labor market, the UX labor market, especially, you know, I think is a problem. And I know in our pre-discussion, we were discussing a company who I know of who's has 50% turnover year over year. And a lot of that, I believe, is that they are hiring people and not really understanding what UX is. They don't really know what they want to get out of these people. Mm-hmm. They're really not, I would say, engaging these employees as individuals as much as they're looking at, we need to fill a seat on a project team. So we're just kind of, okay, we need a UX designer too. Great, got them, put them there. And so they aren't really valuing people and investing in them. You know, I guess I'm going to take something of a counterpoint here. You know, I actually think that when you engage and do try to train people and give them opportunities to shine, I think that builds engagement and makes them more loyal. I mean, speaking for myself, you know, I've been very fortunate throughout my career. I actually got 2 master's degrees that were paid for by my employer. And they also gave me great opportunities along the way. And you're absolutely right. The right time to leave, which is the time that I left, was when I looked at when I looked around my cubicle and said, you know, I think this is as good as it gets here. And, you know, I wish, you know, the company would make more opportunities available to me so that I could repay the investment that they made in me, but I've met my contract, my contractual obligations. And I think it's time to go on, or else I will simply wither. So, you know, maybe yes. That's a little bit more, a little more responsible than many people, but I don't know. I think that investing in people, giving them opportunities to shine is good. Now, you know, here's the other thing. I don't remember exactly what the numbers are, but you have to think about what engagement means in the American workplace. You know, I can't remember the exact number. I know I've talked about this previously with both you and another friend of mine. I mean, you got to figure in the workplace, probably you have 5 to 10% of your employees who are truly engaged, really working to move the organization forward, right? They're really active and really trying to move things forward. You probably have about another 60 to 80% of your employees who are not really actively engaged. I mean, they're doing the job, but they're not really moving the bar. And then the scary number is you probably have about 20 to 30% who are actively disengaged. And I know my math is bad on this, but just work with me here because I don't know the exact numbers, but it's fuzzy. But you got to figure it's about 20 to 30% of people in your company who are actively disengaged. And what that means is whenever, you know, you have people in the top 5 to 10% who are wanting to improve the company, who are wanting to improve performance, who are advocating for change in a company, they are working against people in that 20 to 30% actively disengaged who don't want to make changes. They want to just keep cashing those checks and not have to change things. Don't make people do work. And so I think that's just kind of the dynamics that we have in the workplace. And that's broader than UX. That's just the labor market.
One of the things that comes to mind when I hear Ben talk about those numbers is another aspect of churn, something I talk about a lot in my LinkedIn posts and something I've talked to some people about one-on-one many times, is that I'm under the impression, I was listening to an old interview that I did with Brave UX, and the word that the person mentioned when they were talking about certain posts that I make, he said that, he mentioned the word crisis, that UX is in a state of crisis right now. And yeah, I definitely agree that with that. One of the things that's grossly under the radar, in my opinion, is that there's a lot, when you get those numbers that Ben just talked about, and you've got a very small percentage that's really trying to really steer the ship in the right direction and really help us to excel at what we do. Because I'm firmly of the belief that you're always doing more than one thing when you're doing UX work. You're doing the work, but you're also an ambassador, and you're helping to drive the perception of the discipline and the value perception of UX and things of that nature. There are all these things going on. Well, when you've got 10% of people that are actually aware and trying to do that, and you've got 60 to 90% that are in those other two categories who actually find offense in somebody that's trying to take the UX work forward, that turns into what we call a toxic work environment. And so I said all that to say that a lot of the UX environments that I've heard about, a lot that I've been in over the course of my career, are grossly toxic. And people who, this is give an example of an environment I did not work in, was I delivered a talk on, I believe I did deliver this talk at Kent State. I may have, may not have, but there's a talk that I do sometimes. It's called Heuristics, the Holy Grail of UX, and how that heuristics is something that we've gotten away from over the years. Oh, people will look at the Jacob Nielsen poster and they'll talk about it, but they don't actually apply it. They don't, there's a lot of that today too. People want to sling buzzwords, but they don't really want to engage with different things from an application perspective. And I deliver this talk at Michigan State University for World Usability Day. And there was a person who saw the talk. It was all done during the pandemic, it was done remotely. And the person was really excited about, and it impacted them, really excited about the topic, and talked about wanting to get more involved and apply heuristics in their standard operation. Went back and told their team, a team at a large digital agency who has been hiring those people to just get by. It's like they're hiring the 60 to 80%, those other two contingents, knowingly hiring them. And so the person went back and talked to them about that. And really, yeah, heuristics, this is great. Yeah, we should be doing more heuristics. We should be thinking about heuristics more. We should be applying it to our work. And they just attacked. They just began to complain. They began to push back. Was it because the information I shared about heuristics was incorrect? No. Was it because the information I shared about heuristics was a crackpot theory or a proposition? No. They don't know anything about heuristics, and they don't want to level up. So what I did was I run into, and these are people I didn't even work with. I've worked with those same personas before. And when you try to get people to level up, when you try to get people to be better at their craft, when you try to get people, when you start talking accountability, you start to get this jagged edge kind of an environment that kicks into play, and it results in churn, because that's one of, I've talked to a lot of people. I'm not the only one. Look at my LinkedIn profile. I haven't stayed anywhere very long. I mean, UX years are like dog years to me anyway. So when you stay somewhere 3 years, it's like you were there really for 12 or 15. But the longest stint I've had as a UXer has been about 3.5 years, roughly, if I remember correctly. And I'm not ashamed of it, because you're only going to be able to do so much. Thinking about the example Ben just gave, you look around, this is the best it's going to get here. And sometimes you look around and you see the blood dripping from the teeth and the daggers. Remember that old trilogy of terror movie with the little doll? Yeah, 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 yeah. And he was running around. You know, you got somebody in the corner like this, and you got somebody in the other corner going, red rum, you know. And when you see this, you're not going to be able to stay in that environment very long.
Like, oh, it worked.
I mean, the stories I could tell, and I'll say this one more thing and then hand it over again, and we get ready to go into the wrap-up phase. Thinking about heuristics, in that talk, I talk about it's great for heuristics to be the first thing out of your toolbox. If you try to do research and you haven't looked at it heuristically first, you're going to end up, it should inform your research. It can be formative, it can be summative. There are so many things you can do with heuristics, but when you don't have it in mind, it's problematic. So I'm working at one company, nameless company, and the first thing I did looking at, when I came on board, they were already trying to get things done. I'm trying to get things cleaned up and get us back to a good starting point. So I do a heuristic analysis. And on everything, the first thing I do is a heuristic analysis. And this one guy knew nothing about UX before I got there, was angry because their agency was mad because I was backfilling them. They were losing their contract because I got hired. So their goal was to make me seem irrelevant so that they could maintain their contract and keep making money. So they had no intention on cooperating with me at all. And so the one guy says one day when we're about to work on another part of the project, he says, well, you know, you can go ahead and do that heuristic stuff because that's what you like to do. He just downplays the heuristics as if it doesn't bring any value, when the truth of the matter was he knows nothing about heuristics. And I talk about having a personal heuristics repository. It's empty and full of cobwebs. His was. So it's just interesting. So toxic. I actually almost died working for that company. Some people listening to this podcast will know. That's where I almost ran myself in the ground. And so that became another instance of churn. Because I'm like, I did exactly what Michelle said. I took on a job paying less money. These people paid me through the nose, money I never thought I'd see as a UX professional. And you got bonuses twice a year. You just walk up and hand you $18,000, $20,000. You know, like, whoa. And that twice a year. But it's not worth it if you're not going to be there to spend it.
Well, and Darren, I think, you know, you kind of touch on something that I wanted to mention is it was a book. There was a businessman, a very wealthy businessman from Cleveland. I believe it was Morton Mandel. He wrote a book. It's All About Who You Hire. And he was, you know, it was required reading when I was at Weatherhead School of Management. And he had a really very similar philosophy on hiring. I mean, I told you my rough estimates on numbers, but he basically said, look, there's A employees, B employees, and C employees. A employees are the ones you want. They're the ones that move things forward. They're the ones that are, you know, winners. They like to be measured. They like to know how they're doing. They like to know if they can improve. Your B players, they get the work done, but ultimately they detract from A players. And C players, are the ones that you really do not want. They are detractors. And if you have too many C players, and you don't want C players, yep. basically. Yep. But if you do, but if a company starts hiring C players and B players, you know what happens? The A players leave because A players want to play with A players. And so, yeah, churn also, it's not bad people leaving. It's good people being forced out sometimes.
Yep.
Because of bad hiring practices.
Absolutely. And UX, and hiring practices in UX, grossly dysfunctional today on average. Grossly dysfunctional. Churn is built into the hiring process. Yep. It's built in. I interviewed at a company once. Thought it was beautiful. Best written job description. One of the best written job descriptions I ever saw in my life. And I was the CX manager there. I come in, and the week I came through the door, two of the people that interviewed with me, two of the people that sold me on coming there, go, man, I get to work with that person. That person is dynamite. How great it would be. I think we've all been excited because I get to work with a particular person. But the week I came through the door, they were both leaving. Nobody thought to tell me. One person was leaving the company. The other person was going to a different department. And wow. And Simon Legree, I know that I'm really dating myself using that reference, but Simon Legree and Snidely Whiplash came in and took their place. I really dated myself with that. You got to go look that up, folks, on Google.
I have no idea who that person is.
Simon, these are old, like, robber bear, just really nasty, mean guys who come in and just vicious. One of them, I was working remote mostly. I was actually hybrid. So I would go to the office twice a week and work at home the rest of the week. So when I got the new boss, he wanted me to come in every day. Well, that's not what we agreed to when I came on board. And the company wanted me to start right away. It makes me think about Ben's other story. They wanted me to start right away. So I did. I left. I turned in my notice because I know the other company didn't care. And I was being tortured at the other company. If you ever heard me tell my white supremacist story, that was the other company where we interviewed a guy that was a white supremacist. And I told them, you can't hire this guy because he spent the whole second half of the interview harassing me. And then they hired him anyway. So I guess that was the green light. So he would spend half of his day harassing me. So I just, I'm out. I left. And then when I came, it's just a really long, weird story, but it's just amazing the things that would happen. Churn, it costs so much to replace an employee. It costs so much. And uh-huh. and it just, it shouldn't be that way. And you know, to try to make companies relevant for employees, to try to make sure to cater to them, to understand their needs, the work that goes into that, a lot of people are not aware of it. And it's just an amazing thing. When you really get into the weeds about churn, it's really, I'll stop there, but it's just really, really, really strange. But we got the last topic, and then we're going to shift. I believe, Ben, it's your turn.
Okay.
And this time we're gonna wrap up today by talking about empowerment. And how UXers, the need for UXers to be empowered in the work that they do and how valuable that is. So I know we were talking about this before we started recording as well.
You know, I think ultimately UXers really need to have the ability and the space to do their work. And that's what empowerment really is. It's all about. I mean, I think the most satisfied, most successful UXers are those who are allowed to do their work. I think the UXers, and again, it kind of gets back to churn and engagement and job satisfaction. If you're on a UX team where you're just being asked, okay, yeah, just give us a nice looking button here. You're not doing any really interesting work. That is disempowering. If you are working with a Scrum team and design decisions are being made without consulting their UX person, that's disempowering. Whenever a UX person says, okay, not a bad idea, can we test it before we develop it so that we know that we're developing the right thing? And you kind of get the stiff arm that says, no, we don't need to test it because we know how to do it. That's disempowering. And I think that really kind of is informative of what is a good workplace, what is, and by the way, empowering UXers, by the way, ultimately empowers the enterprise or the organization.
Yes. Yes.
Because if you hire these UXers, which, I mean, they're good paying jobs generally, You should get as much out of them as you can. You don't hire smart people to take orders. You hire smart people to help you to do better.
Yeah.
You want to hire somebody to take orders? Don't hire smart people. And then I would say, I think a lot of the, you know, really well-trained, you know, committed people in UX generally are pretty smart and interested in doing things to improve their company and really see outcomes. You know, it kind of comes back to that A, B, and C players. A players like to be measured. They like to see success and they'll work for it. So, and that is empowerment. And then, you know, it's why I left any job I've left generally because I was not empowered to do the best work I could do.
That's amazing stuff. I'll throw one thing in here before we jump over to Michelle. You make me think about the concept of underutilization. Yeah. That you bring in smart people and then you don't let them do what they're capable of doing. I talk a lot of times about spreading my wings. And I had a conversation with somebody one day and they, you got to stop talking about spreading your wings, Darren. No, you need to understand what I mean by that. I want to be able to spread my wings and fly. And it's a contrast point. Can I spread my wings and do what I'm capable of doing? Or are people always trying to clip them? Because if you clip the wings at a certain point, that bird can't fly. So if you have wings, you can't fly. And I've been in environments where that was indeed the case. So, and so I think about empowerment from that perspective. Allow the people to fly. Allow them to soar. If they're a sparrow, then they're going to fly so high. If they're an eagle, they're going to go even higher. But let people fly based on whatever their capabilities are and don't strip them down. Because eventually, that's going to become counterproductive and then back to churn. If people know they can fly and you won't let them, because they've seen it and they've done it, it's a matter of time before that person is no longer on your team. It's the reality of it. But Michelle.
Yeah, so empowerment is one of the things that is, I guess, drives me, that and like that sense of meaning and that what I'm doing has value. But I mean, I left a job recently and I've told someone that I felt like a surgeon whose job was to put Band-Aids on gunshot wounds. That's what I felt like on a daily basis. And
like that.
It's like, it's hard when you have, I've tried my entire career to just keep learning stuff. That's why I've, you know, went and got an MBA and did all these things and certifications and blah, blah, blah. Because I want to have more value that I can present to any company I work for. When I'm in an environment where I am not empowered, where maybe there's cultural reasons or there's whatever kind of reasons where I can't do the things I need to do. Like at this particular place, I could not do any research whatsoever at all. And I basically had to product owners who were like, we know what the users need. We know what the company needs, blah, 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 blah. That's what I had to deal with. And so I was like, everything I did, it's like, well, okay, you want me to do the best guess. Here we go. I didn't feel empowered at all except to guess, which is what I did there. I was paid to guess. Yeah. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't feel empowered at all to do my job because they were not, and it wasn't anything nefarious. It's just they did not understand UX properly and didn't know how to give it the space it needed to do it properly and the value of it. And I knew that they were interested in it. It's just it would have required such a cultural shift at that company to change and be what I needed it to be for me to just be able to use what I knew, forget about growing. There was absolutely no way for me to grow there. So to me, empowerment in a UX role is, can you utilize the skills that you have, right? And if it's UX, if you don't have data and like research-driven information to drive your design, then you're guessing. And if you're a real UXer, the last thing you ever want to do is be guessing. Right, that it makes your soul have to do that, right? And so you want to actually use the skills you have and do the job properly. But then you also want to know that you have authority. That I've been lucky that I've worked on product teams where it was understood. UX does, they make these decisions, right? Nobody can override them except, you know, if they've got to be someone really high up, right? Developers cannot override me. The product owner cannot override me, you know, whatever. So I've been very fortunate, but there are a lot of people who work on Scrum teams and things like that, where any random developer can override them. The PO can override them, a BA or whatever. And so they're just there looking at a story that says make page do X. okay. And then they go make Paige do X. They are not empowered. And that stuff makes me so sad. And I try to coach people when I have the opportunity to do that. When I mentor some people who work in these kind of environments, and I try to give them, you know, here's some things you can do to try to empower yourself in that role so that you can actually present yourself in such a way that it's understood that these decisions here, those are mine. They don't belong to you, you know? And like, you know, luckily because I have that background in front end development, I used to manage a development team. If developers try to mess with me, don't do that, because you want me to mess with your code, don't you? You really want me to go do that.
Exactly.
But you have to teach people how to empower themselves. I have worked in places where when I first got hired, I was expected as a UX designer to just do visual design. And I was like, oh, hell no. I didn't come here to just color what a wireframe that one of your architects gave me. I'm like, that's a waste of my time. So I had to prove that I could do all of these things. And then I changed the entire role and I made it exactly what I needed it to be. Mm-hmm. And then of course I got laid off, because everybody got laid off because of life, but not because of that, but I empowered myself to make that role exactly what I wanted it. And I've done that at every single job I've ever had. I've changed that role and I've made it better for myself. So I try to teach people that I talk to how to maybe be more assertive and to empower themselves. Don't wait for anybody to give you the power to do a thing. You've got to give it to yourself and act like you already have the authority to own these decisions. And I know that's hard for some people to do, but that is what I've done. And it's generally worked out pretty well for me. So empower yourself.
Yeah, it's the reality of it. And you make me think about managing up. That's something that does not cross a lot of people's minds, but there are times you need to manage up. You might not be the manager. That doesn't mean that you will not be managing something. And a lot of times when you are a subordinate, when you're reporting to somebody, you still need to, when you recognize, you know what? There are some things I need to do to make this thing work. So you have to manage up. You can be a manager and you might have to manage up when it comes to your superiors. Mm-hmm. And you're not a manager, but you have to manage up, because maybe you're one of those people on a team that you have a person running UX, it's common today, who knows nothing about UX and doesn't understand what's going on or how to do the work. That means that part of your time, you have to manage up. Were you about to say, Ben?
I said, stop the madness.
it's so tough. And it's funny how I saw something that Debbie posted. She made a comment how that she talked about something and people were coming at her and fighting her. And then somebody else said the same exact thing. Reminds me of the old FedEx commercial where one guy said something and then the next guy comes behind him and he just moves his hand from left to right. He said the same exact thing, but everybody thought that that was the best thing since sliced bread. And it's funny. That's what Debbie was talking about, how that, you know, the madness, we can't stop the madness until everybody gets on the critical thinking train and it starts to think more level-headed about things. Otherwise, we're just going to keep riding this out. For me, I'm on the back end of the mountain, so to speak, because I can see retirement up ahead. So I'm actually fighting for other people, but we'll do what we can to help. And I can't help, but there are times I've tried to stop fighting this fight, and I end up picking it right back up again. I just can't stop. I've gone on leaves on LinkedIn. I didn't know. Did you know that they have the little auto responder on LinkedIn? I could do that.
Oh, I got one of your responses one time. Like, he just texted me on LinkedIn and it's saying he's not here. I'm like,
I was lurking. But sometimes I just have to step away, because it just, you can't focus on these things. There's not enough people sometimes that are cooperating. And so sometimes you just have to get away, but I can't step away from the fight. So until I retire, you folks got me. So I'll do what I can. But thanks, folks. This was dynamite. It's funny, when this podcast started, we were always told that to shoot for 23 to 24 minutes. And over the last 3 or 4 months, we have pretty much broken that model. But you know what? Listenership is going up. And we're bringing value. It's like counting clicks. You know, the myth of counting clicks. People don't care about counting clicks. And it turns, it is best practice to keep a podcast in that time range, but people are enjoying this longer format. And so sometimes we do it, sometimes we don't. I know people are going to love the input that you folks have shared today. So thank you, Michelle, for being here. Thank you, Ben, for being here. Thank you for sharing from your treasure chest today with folks who are here. But it is time for a wrap-up statement. So we will close the show before I sign off with a closing remark from each of you. So Michelle, you get to kick this part off.
Okay, I'll close with what I just said in regards to empowerment. Empower yourself. And what I mean by that is not just in giving your voice as a UXer power, but know that your career belongs to you. Don't expect your company to improve your career or to try to do things for you. Don't expect other people to make your career what it is. It's your career. Own it. Do everything you can to make it what you want it to be. All that power is yours. And then once you have a job in it, in UX, you need to continue to empower your own role and to make it what you need it to be and to fight within wherever you're at to give UX the place it deserves and also to give the responsibility of UX squarely to you and your role and to be able to present it out so that, you know, developers or BAs or whatever can't steal it from you. Don't let anyone steal UX from you. It's yours. And that's that.
Yes. Awesome. Awesome. And Ben, your closing remarks today.
Sure. You know, I think I'll actually kind of direct my closing remarks to folks who are looking for those UX jobs, but also for hiring managers who are looking to hire UX practitioners. And, you know, one of the questions I've gotten throughout my career as an educator, trainer, and now, you know, UX professional is, what does it take to be a good UX professional? And I would say there's real, and by the way, and to kind of flip that, what makes a good UX job if I'm trying to hire a UX professional? And what I would say is what makes a good UX professional is ultimately what drives a UX professional. And that is, they just have an innate curiosity about how things work and how people interact with things. Why do people do things the way they do, and how can we improve things? And also, the second part is, there's a slight bit of dissatisfaction with the way things are. If you walk through life and you don't see anything that needs to be changed, UX probably isn't for you. If you walk through life and you find something every day that needs to be fixed, UX is probably a good job. And like I said, for people who are creating UX jobs, if you're in an enterprise or an agency or a consultancy, you know, understanding that is what drives good, powerful, empowered UXers will help you to kind of create those opportunities and those great jobs. And by the way, if you have those opportunities, you'll get the most you can out of those UX professionals, whether they're entry level, mid level, or senior level.
Phenomenal stuff. It's gold, folks. Do something with it and do the right thing. This is absolute gold. And we say all the time, part of what I want to do on this podcast is bring other voices that people need to hear, because there's a lot of noise today in UX and a lot of folks saying stuff that if you ignored it, you wouldn't be any worse off. This information that these folks are sharing today will vault you forward in the discipline. So I'm thankful for people that are tuning in. Thanks to those of you out there that have helped us to continue these 2 years. We're in our second year, beginning our third year, because people have found what we're doing valuable. So I want to keep bringing people like this who can share things that will help you to be better at your craft. And then you can get into the battle and you can help vault the disciplines forward. Yes, you are being enlisted. So thanks again, Ben. Thanks again, Michelle. And I know we'll have you folks on again. We just keep bringing folks back from time to time. But I'm really happy to have had you today. And we look forward to seeing who we're going to share next week. I don't know exactly who's going to be on next week's episode, but we got to get some more of the old guard back to share additional thoughts on the discipline. So, folks, that is all the time we have today. Thank you for sharing in this extended anniversary episode of The World of UX. But it is time to sign off now. So this is Darren Hood, the host of The World of UX. Happy UXing, everybody.
Thanks for joining us for this session of CX of M Radio. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and visit cxofm.org for more resources.
RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.